Welcome to Socrates in the Studio, which falls under the rubric and perhaps also the aegis of Socrates in the City. We are in the city of New York City, and I am today going to be speaking with Arthur C. Brooks, not to be confused with the other Arthur Brookses. He has a book out now, another book called The Happiness Files, Insights on Work and Life. Arthur Brooks is the Parker Gilbert Montgomery Professor at the Harvard Kennedy School and a professor of management practice at Harvard Business School. He's also a columnist at The Atlantic, where he writes the weekly How to Build a Life column. He's the number one New York Times bestselling author of 14 books, including Build the Life You Want, co-authored with Oprah Winfrey. Not making that up. And here he is, Arthur Brooks. Arthur, welcome.
Eric.
Great to see you.
You too.
So normally I would make that up. That would be my kind of a joke, co-offered with Oprah Winfrey, and it would get a big laugh.
Yeah.
In fact, that's true.
That turns out to be true. Yes, indeed.
I don't know a lot of people who've co-authored books with Oprah Winfrey. That's extraordinary. I have to ask you before we get into the brand new book.
Right.
How did that come about?
It was her idea, actually. So it turns out that during the coronavirus epidemic, when everybody was, well, in most places around the United States, we were all deeply locked down.
Yeah.
She was at her place in California, and she was reading my column every week. You know, she walks around her place, and she would read my column every Thursday morning in The Atlantic, How to Build a Life. And she really liked it. And when a book came out during that period called From Strength to Strength, Finding Happiness, Purpose in the Second Half of Life, she read it on the first day and called and asked me to be on her podcast. She has a podcast. She's a voracious reader, and she's a very discerning reader, too. And she had me on to talk about my book, From Strength to Strength, and we kind of hit it off. She's a very interesting person. She's very smart. She's a very erudite person. And we were, you know, getting along like a house on fire. And what do you know, not a few weeks later, she called my cell phone and said, you know, I've been thinking about it. If I still had my show, I'd have you on 30 times. I said, huh, that would have been great. And she said, but I don't have a show, so how about if I host you in a book? I said, what do you mean? And the result was that book, where she's kind of the host of the book, and I'm
really?
The guest. I'm, you know, the guy talking about all the material inside the book, and it was a great experience.
I mean, the idea of somebody of that stature saying, I would like to write a book with you is wonderful. It's extraordinary. Of course, it speaks well of you, Arthur, but... I mean, listen, even if I didn't know that you had co-written a book with Oprah Winfrey, I just have to look at the back of this book. Huh. And this is other stuff. It sounds like Eric's making it up. There's a blurb here from His Holiness the Dalai Lama and a blurb from George Stephanopoulos. I know George has read and admired one of my books about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but I don't
Everybody
know.
Everybody loves that book.
You think? I don't know.
I love that book. That's a great
book. I think it's overrated.
Do you really?
No.
Really? Have you renounced it?
Yes, I've renounced. It's like Tolstoy renounced all of his works of fiction at the end of his life.
He's like, he didn't get back the royalties. You'll notice that.
I didn't. Yeah, but he probably gave the royalties to the peasants.
Or one of his 13 children.
We've stumbled far away from the fact that you have a new book out called The Happiness Files. Now, this is, in fact, a collection of some of the best columns that you've published in The Atlantic on the How to Build a Life column. So we have to start with, I have to start with, you know, Socrates in the City is about asking the big questions. So it's not just sort of like, you know, great tips on how to have a better life, but to actually ask what would that mean or what is that? So let me start with the question. You are genuinely an expert on the subject of happiness. So what is happiness, or what does it mean to you when somebody says, you know, happiness?
Yeah. I mean, happiness is a word that can mean sort of everything and nothing, and it gets people's attention. But as a behavioral scientist, that's how I'll answer the question. And, you know, I could address it more philosophically or as a Christian, but as a behavioral scientist, the thing to understand about happiness to begin with is it's not a feeling. It's not an emotion. And that's really important.
And actually, what's important is that you just said what I neglected to say. you're a behavioral scientist.
Yeah.
So you're not just somebody who's thought about this. You've studied it, and you come at it from that perspective.
I suffered through a PhD.
You suffered through a PhD.
Yeah, exactly.
So say more about that.
Yeah.
Happiness, because there are, I think it's a legitimate question that, you know, most people would have if they're given a moment to say, well, what is happiness?
Yeah, and you know, I usually compare it to, for example, something that you and I have talked about a lot in our various walks of life, which is love. And, you know, most people think that love is a feeling, and this is one of the reasons that marriages don't tend to last, because you pursue a feeling. Well, that's an exercise in futility. To love is to will the good of the other, according to St. Thomas Aquinas. That's a really
important
distinction.
What does he know?
Yeah, what, you know, really. I mean, it's,
but to, you know, in all seriousness,
that old guy,
what you
he was
just
never
said,
married.
To even go, to ask the question, what is happiness, that's important. Then to ask, what is love?
Yeah.
Because you've just said it, and of course, Aquinas was, of course, correct.
Yeah.
But say that again, because this is, I guess for me, part of the reason I do Socrates in the City is because we have a lot of bad ideas.
Right.
We walk around with bad ideas.
Right. And those bad
thinking
ideas
of love,
hurt us. They hurt us.
And they, other people.
For sure.
And so to think of love as a feeling, is there a more, I mean, I almost can't think of a more pernicious idea.
Oh, it's the worst. And, you know, I've been married almost 34 years. If love were a feeling, I wouldn't have been married 34 minutes. Because I married a Spaniard, and they're very quarrelsome people. and so the truth is that my love for my wife, my love for God, my love for my friends, my love for my country, these are all different kinds of love, but what do they have in common? They're an act of commitment and will. Aquinas, who was channeling Aristotle and everything he wrote in the Summa Theologiae, I mean, that's where modern audiences at the time became acquainted with Aristotle, the greatest student of Plato. They were all Platonists before that, of course. And the student of Socrates. And Aristotle talked about love as this act of commitment notwithstanding your feelings, which led Thomas Aquinas to define love as to will the good of the other. And then theologians later put a little tag on the end, as other. To will the good of the other as other.
Now, why did who put the tag on the end?
Well, that was actually Michael Novak, of all
Michael
people.
Novak.
Who is a Thomistic scholar.
To will the good of the other as other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Your wife loves you as you, not as an appendage of her.
Right.
And in so doing, she truly wants your good, which is heavenly love.
Right.
That's what it really means. That is to be, if God is love, that's what it means for us to love. And that's an act and a commitment because it goes against our feelings a lot of the time. And that is the moral imperative. That's what sets us apart. That's the divinity in mankind, is to defy your animal instincts and to love somebody despite actually how you feel in a particular moment. And that's the essence of being fully alive.
Well, you know, speaking as Christians, it's the same thing. When somebody says, this is funny. I wasn't going to bring this up, but I find this hilarious and delightful. one thing that we have in common, we have a few things in common, but one thing that we have in common is both of us
wear nice head of hair. Nice head of hair.
This is a horsehair wig. I'm very open about that.
So where do you get your horsehair wigs?
As horse a kid, my father took me to a ranch, and it was a real bonding thing. I picked out the horse. One of the things we have in common is that both of us, about a decade apart, were invited to be the main speaker at the National Prayer Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
And when you spoke, I spoke when Obama was president, you spoke during Trump's first term, but when you spoke, you talked about, because we're talking about it right now, the concept of loving your enemies.
Right.
If you define love incorrectly, as nearly everyone does, because the culture defines it incorrectly,
right.
You cannot begin to comprehend the idea of loving your enemy. It's an absurdity.
The whole Sermon on the Mount is nuttiness if you're being guided by your feelings.
Right.
It's just impossible, because the Sermon on the Mount is a master class in managing your emotions so they don't manage you, which is the essence of being a fully alive being in God's image. This is, for a behavioral scientist, holy moly, the Sermon on the Mount is the best thing ever. And Matthew 5:44 is the apex of that. You know, you've heard that you should love your friends and hate your enemies, but today I give you a new teaching, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. He might as well just put in parentheses, I don't care about your feelings, because you're bigger than your feelings if you're living in the image of God. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. This is what sets us apart from the animals. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, that people often talk about how, you know, the Christian spirit is somehow at odds with the Enlightenment. And I know the spirit of Socrates in the cities is saying, no. Because in point of fact, love your enemies is the basis of the Enlightenment. Only a culture and society that could embrace this at scale would say, you know, I don't have to coerce people, I can persuade them. And the way that I can do that is willing their good by giving them better ideas than they currently have and not beating them over the head and forcing these ideas upon them. Love your enemies is the basis of a good secular society and not just a good Christian society.
Because even a society that thinks of itself as secular is bound by living in this thing we call reality, which happens to be invented by the God of the Bible, even though not everybody has to acknowledge that explicitly. Still are obliged to live in the world of reality.
Yeah, well, you have to live in the world of reality, but also there are certain rules that you accept because you want to get along day after day. And there are a lot of people who would like to turn back the clock and turn everything back into force, to be sure. There are people among us, even here in the United States, that would like to force us to bend to the will of what... And that's contrary not just to my faith, but it's also contrary to the principles of the Enlightenment. This is what we're going through in the kind of culture wars on campuses today, as a matter of fact. We're fighting over the Enlightenment on campuses.
That's so interesting. We've gone from... I want to come back just to this idea of what love is, because you can tell already, this is the big issue for me, because I think if I have to identify what is deeply harmful in Western culture, that to me is it.
Yeah.
The idea that love is a feeling.
Yeah.
But it's ubiquitous. It's taken over the culture so dramatically over so many decades that talking about it as you've just done is radical.
Yeah, no, it sounds weird, and yet it's the least radical thing possible. And, you know, we got on this because we were talking about what is happiness. But if you don't understand what love is, you can't understand what happiness is, which also isn't a feeling. One of the biggest problems that we have, what lies behind the explosion among young adults of depression and anxiety starts with a misperception of what happiness is, which is that it's a feeling. And I want that feeling. And I hope tomorrow morning I have that feeling. And I hope when I marry my beloved, I have the feeling an awful lot. Well, good luck to you. Good luck to you. That's not the way it works, and that's not the way it's supposed to work. And life wouldn't even be good if it did work that way.
So what then is happiness? If happiness is not the feeling that, hey, everything's great and I'm happy and everything's going well for me now, what is it?
Happiness and feelings are related, like the smell of your turkey is related to your Thanksgiving dinner. Feelings are evidence of happiness. Happiness is something for behavioral scientists that is a tangible thing. And like your Thanksgiving dinner, it has macronutrients. Thanksgiving dinner is a combination of protein, carbohydrates, and fat, if you're kind of a science nerd like me or a nutrition freak. And happiness has three macronutrients as well that are identifiable, we're able to study and get better at. Mm-hmm. They're enjoyment, which is to enjoy your life, satisfaction, which is to take joy in your accomplishments after struggle, which means there's unhappiness in there, and meaning, which is the biggest one of all, the why of your life, the coherence, the purpose, the significance of your life. Those are big projects. And that's such good news because nobody's great at all those things. So we all have margin not to be perfectly happy, which we shouldn't be in this life, but to be happier and to make progress. I mean, I believe that pure happiness does occur, just not on this side of the mortal coil. On this side, we're going to have negative experiences and emotions, and that's as it should be.
You have what I would describe as a standard biblical view that we're fallen. We're living in a world where things aren't the way they're supposed to be. So then the question is, what do we do about that?
Right.
And it seems to me that your research and many of your writings have to do with answering that question.
That's right.
What do we do given things as they are.
Yeah, and the answer is, what can we? I mean, the question is, what can we do to be perfectly happy, which is that's futile, but to become happier as a person, and to do that, you need to understand how happiness works, enjoyment, satisfaction, and meaning, to change your habits and behaviors, and then the most important part to make it sticky, which is what I teach my students, is to become a happiness teacher. Now, this sounds an awful lot like every good religion, probably, which is to understand how things work, change your own life, and pass on the good news. And that's exactly how it works in science as well.
It doesn't sound like most of the religions that I'm familiar with. So we'll just skip that conversation. But I think it's...
the Bible, change your life, and spread the good news.
Well, it sounds like that religion.
Okay.
But...
Well, that one.
And there are many people who, you know, even within the biblical tradition would quibble. But the three things you mentioned, enjoyment.
Right. Satisfaction.
Satisfaction and meaning.
Right.
Meaning, to me, you know, it's at the heart of everything. The meaning of, I often talk about the meaning of meaning. Why do we care about meaning? Right. Like, what does it say about us? Yeah. What does it mean that we care about meaning? And maybe not everybody does care about meaning. So make the case for the meaning part of this equation.
It's the big one. It's the biggest one of all, as a matter of fact. And it lies behind the explosion of depression and anxiety among young people. I have data that very clearly indicate that there's no recession in enjoyment and satisfaction in young people's lives. But people are farther away from being able to articulate and understand the meaning of their lives than we've ever seen in any time since we've been keeping good social science data on this issue. Does your life feel meaningless? The answer is more likely to be yes now than ever. And this inability to understand what the meaning of life might even be. I'm actually finishing a book right now called The Meaning of Your Life, Finding Purpose in an Age of Emptiness, that looks at the...
Reading it or writing it?
I'm writing it.
Writing it.
I'm writing it. It's actually done. It's going to come out next April.
Okay.
April of 2026, God willing. And, I mean, it's supposed to. It's April 14th. It's, you know, slotted. And the manuscript is done. And as you know well, as an author, this is... The very end is the worst, because writing a book is like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's Stages of Death and Dying, right? Anger, denial, bargaining. Finally, you get to acceptance. I'm not there yet. Depression, I'm not there to acceptance.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we find is that this idea of coherence, why things happen the way they do, purpose, the goals and direction in life, and significance, why my life matters, this is almost impossible for people to articulate who've been completely inculcated in a culture that's been... where they've distracted themselves with social media, with dating apps, with technology that's literally discouraging them from using the parts of the brain that are necessary to apprehend the dark consciousness within which an understanding of meaning resides. Also, where you can feel God's presence.
I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who, whether they would be able to do it explicitly, would nonetheless say, I don't know that life has meaning. In other words, I can say that life has meaning because I know that a God who is infinite love deliberately created me for his purposes.
How would you articulate the meaning of your life?
How would I articulate meaning?
Yeah, the meaning of your life, which I guess your personal mission statement, but... And probably you've done this before, but if somebody says, what is the meaning of Eric Metaxas' life according to Eric Metaxas? What would you say?
I don't, before I attempt to answer that, I guess what I'm getting at is I can see a lot of people say, look, I don't believe in God, so I believe that we're just here. We just evolved out of the primordial soup, which is scientifically preposterous, but everybody seems to believe it, that we just arrived here. If that is the case, if we arrived here as the end result of an accidental process, then it would follow logically that our lives actually don't have meaning, but for some reason we have to talk about our lives as though they have meaning, or people will sort of say things like, well, I have, you know, I create my own meaning or something like that. But thinking on the larger level, why would somebody need to think that their life has meaning, or that they have value?
They won't be happy. As an empirical proposition, people will have a much lower quality of life if they're either unaware of, don't understand, or believe that their life doesn't have meaning. That's just a fact. And part of the reason for it is that we're teleological creatures. We need a telos. And this is a very Aristotelian notion. We have to have a why of our lives. People who actually can articulate a why of their lives, which, you know, by the way, there are a lot of pretty happy people who aren't Christians like you and I are, and they think not of meaning in a supernatural context, but they do think about it in a pretty robust and in a decent way, as far as I'm concerned. But what they all have in common is that they have an understanding of the answers to three questions. Why are things happening the way they are? You know, some people will say it's, you and I say it's, the work of the Lord. Some people will say it's science. Some people will say it's conspiracies by powerful individuals. The second question is, what are your goals? Why am I doing what I'm doing? What are my goals and direction in life? What's my intention in life? And last but not least, why does it matter that I'm alive? To whom? To whom does it matter that I'm alive? And if you have an answer to those questions, you do pretty well. Now, I happen to believe that there is a supernatural, a true metaphysical dimension to it, but I do know also that true secularists, when they have an understanding of those three dimensions, they do well too. They do well too. I would take issue about whether or not they're metaphysically correct. That's all.
But I think that's what I mean. I think that if we're to be intellectually honest, I think we'd have to admit that to posit that we're here by accident, but that our lives have meaning, is to necessarily fudge a piece of it. Mm. And I think good luck to somebody if they can fudge it, because I do think it matters. Yeah. You know, that, you know, if somebody says, you know, your life is important, you know, right, I would want to say,
why?
Well, like, because you
to
said
whom?
So,
right?
Because you said so. And I think there are a lot of people in despair.
Yeah.
And I think that they are asking a very honest question in saying, like, I don't think my life has meaning.
Right.
Why are you saying it does? I think you're wrong.
Yeah.
Like, why, you know? And now we know that's not helpful, but I think it's a legitimate question.
For sure. And that's actually why I'm writing the book on this. Hardest book I've ever written. I've been working on it for off and on for 5 years. And part of the reason for it is that it's one thing to write a book about standard behavioral science. It's something else entirely to ask the biggest possible questions that go beyond the realm of what the behavioral science will permit you to understand and explain. The problem with meaning is that meaning is adjudicated in the right hemisphere of the brain. The right hemisphere of the brain is where we deal with all. This is, comes from the hemispheric lateralization theory of a neuroscientist at Oxford named Ian McGilchrist, one of the greats of our time.
Ian McGilchrist?
Yeah.
I just interviewed him.
He's great.
I actually did.
He's
and of course he's great.
He's a visionary.
Of course he's great.
Yeah. And what he has understood is that the right hemisphere of the brain is where all the mystery in life is. And yet it goes beyond articulation. So there's a reason I asked you to say, okay, what's the meaning of your life? The truth of the matter is, if you tried to articulate it right now, you'd have to filter it through the language centers of your brain, the Broca's area and Wernicke's area of your brain, which are in the left side of the cortex.
Did you say Wernicke?
Wernicke. Wernicke's area.
Wernicke. Bonhoeffer's father studied under Wernicke.
Oh, my gosh.
I believe. I believe that's correct.
Yeah,
I believe the name Wernicke is in my Bonhoeffer book.
Yeah.
But so he's such a famous brain scientist that he has a part of the brain named for him.
So I'm one degree of separation from Eric, who's one from Bonhoeffer to Bonhoeffer's father to Wernicke. I'm 4 degrees off from Wernicke.
Okay, so forgive me for my really stupid. Please forgive me for my stupid interruptions.
But I like it.
You were
but
just
the
saying
whole
that.
The point is that you'd have to filter through a metaphysical, deep idea to which you have a mysterious, wonderful understanding through the hopeless, helpless little channel of Wernicke and Broca's areas of your brain. It's the same kind of thing if I'd say, Harry, why do you love your wife? And you'd say, she's the mother of my children. She's a wonderful woman. I just really like her values.
That's
anything you'd say would trivialize it.
That's good.
Yeah, so the point is,
that's good.
If you're not spending time in the right hemisphere of the brain, which, by the way, neuroscientists have called dark consciousness. You know, when cosmologists, when astronomers, they don't know what's out there. They call it dark energy and dark matter. Right? The dark matter of your brain, the dark matter of your mind is in the right hemisphere of your brain, which is literally called by many neuroscientists the dark consciousness. And therein you mediate questions of love and questions of faith, questions of all of the theological virtues, certainly. But meaning is that's... And, so here's the question. Why is that turned off in so many young people today? Why is that turned off? And we know why. Because our use of technology is actually shoving us into the left side of the brain where we do tasks, where we do complicated things, where we neglect the complex.
And it is therefore dehumanizing us.
Completely. That's absolutely completely the case.
Yeah.
You know, that's when we distract ourselves because of our misery, when we fritter away our time on our devices, we're neglecting even the possibility of experiencing dark consciousness, where we might be able to understand, even if beyond articulation, the questions of meaning in our lives. And that's what we need to get into. So that's why when you're in periods of deep and intense prayer, that's why you're conscious of the presence of meaning in your life, even though you can't quite say why, because you're using the part of the brain, the God antenna, perhaps.
Yeah.
Onboard hardware.
Yeah.
To understand what really matters in life.
Well, what's interesting to me about your decades of research is that it points through through research, through scientific research, points toward God.
Right.
In other words, even if you don't like the God hypothesis, you kind of you get stuck because it seems that we are created in such a way that this works and that doesn't work,
right.
And this feels good and that doesn't feel good, and this is ultimately satisfying and this is not satisfying.
Right.
And so if you didn't really care too much what you discover, you're just looking like a scientist and trying to look at a human being, and you'd be drifting toward this God hypothesis.
Yeah.
Because even when people talk about like dark, what do you call it?
The dark consciousness.
The dark consciousness. It's funny when people who don't, you know, they don't have a term or they don't know what it is, so they come up with a term and they go, okay, so it's that.
Yeah.
But what is that?
Yeah. No, exactly right. And you know, there are a lot of behavioral scientists who are not religious. They're not, but they tend to look in what we would call sort of partial equilibrium. They look at salami slices of human behavior. And when you start trying to put it together, for me, it's just I can't get away. I'm sucked in. I'm in the vortex. I'm in the God vortex. I can't escape. Because when I look all together into what these things to which my life points, the science points, the experience of life on Earth, what it actually all means, I come up with the Godhead. I come up with the creator of the universe. I can't find a better way to explain it.
Well, that's the issue, right? Is that you know? I always invite people. If you can find a better way of explaining this, I'm open because
right.
I'm only interested in what's true, not
for sure.
In my version of the truth. Well, so to get back to your definition of happiness, it seems that you know part of the appeal of your books is that most people, wherever they come out on you know, the theological or philosophical spectrum, they would like to be happy. And so you've kind of caught them there. You've caught their interest.
It's a good market position. Well,
so what do you say? Now, I know in this book, it's a compilation of columns, but what are the things that you touch on as the points?
First thing that I ask people to do is to think a little bit in their own lives about where they need the most work. I mean, some people have trouble with enjoyment. They do. Some people have trouble actually having purpose and goals and achieving satisfaction, or they can't delay their gratifications. And some people really do have this crisis of meaning that we've been talking about. So I ask people to self-diagnose a little bit and then work on the part of their happiness where their happiness is weakest. You know, I know about myself. My meaning is pretty good, could use work. My satisfaction is just through the roof because of the work that I've been able to do, which is just a gift, but my enjoyment isn't where it should be. I don't enjoy my life as much as I should.
Yeah, talk about that. What do you mean? Because what you're saying is that we ought to enjoy our lives. So you don't mean ought to be seeking pleasure foolishly, but we ought to have some kind of a balanced life in such a way that we will allow ourselves to enjoy life.
What does that mean? It requires that you understand enjoyment, which is not the same thing as pleasure. Pleasure is an animal phenomenon. Pleasure is a function of the limbic system of the brain, a console of tissue that was around up to 40 million years ago. This is pre-human in lots of ways. And what it does is it gives you signals. It gives you a universal language to tell you what's going on around you below your level of consciousness. All of your positive and negative emotions are an indication there's something you should approach or avoid, that these are opportunities or threats. That's what it comes down to. You know, people who think, you know, I hope I have more happy feelings and I hope I have fewer, you know, bad feelings. They don't understand feelings. The truth is this is just information is the whole point. Pleasure is just tapping a little thing in your a lot of it, tapping a little part of your limbic system called the ventral tegmental area and the ventral striatum. You do that and it's like, oh, nice. That's just that pleasure that you actually feel from somebody saying I love you or taking a bump of cocaine. I mean, we have these rudimentary brains that actually give us this feeling. And if you pursue pleasure, if that's your goal in life, well, woe be unto you. You're going to wind up in rehab if you're lucky.
If you're lucky,
you will be managed by your pleasures.
Right.
The secret of enjoyment is actually moving the experience to the prefrontal cortex of the brain, the C-suite right behind your forehead. That's your conscious brain where you make executive decisions. Mm. That takes pleasure. Pleasure's fine. Pleasure's a gift. But you have to add two things to it, people and memory. You have to add people and memory such that you can have an ongoing experience of this, and furthermore, that it becomes social in a conscious way so that you can govern your pleasures and they don't govern you. That's what it comes down to. This is the reason that discipline is so critically important. This is the reason that you say, no, I think the fourth glass of wine isn't for me tonight, because that would be pleasurable but not enjoyable.
Uh-huh.
This is the reason that you don't drink alone. This is the reason that internet use by yourself is a dangerous business.
This is the reason at 1 a.m. you don't start watching Howard the Duck.
You should probably never watch Howard the Duck.
I never will.
Did you know that that is the lowest rated film of all time?
Is that the one that was like executive produced by Bill Cosby in 1986?
I think that's right. But Howard the Duck has been popularly voted on Rotten Tomatoes to be the worst film ever made.
I obviously...
And at 1 a.m.
I only bring this up because you reference in your introductory essay having at some point made the very silly decision at 1 a.m. to leap into watching that movie. I mean, the funny thing
is
there are great movies
right
that you shouldn't start watching at 1 a.m.
Yeah. The truth is that if something gives you pleasure, we're good at pleasure in certain things, different people in different things. The thing that scratches your itch that's different than other people. And it could be addictive, which many things can, everything from carbohydrates to internet, you know, not to mention all the bad and evil things in life, from drugs and alcohol to pornography, all the terrible things in life. If you're using something that could give you pleasure and is addictive and you're using it alone, you're doing it wrong. You know, this is the sort of the rule that I give my students and my kids. It's almost a perfect rule, as a matter of fact, because that's an indication that, you know, we're in this together for all intents and purposes. You know, if there's something that, you know, we have shame when we're around other people, when we're satisfying our pleasures in unseemly ways, and this is one of the ways that we'll actually move the experience to our prefrontal cortex and govern ourselves. Enjoyment is a gift. Enjoyment is a wonderful way that we can actually take the abundance of life, the abundance of creation, and make sure that it is a source of joy to us without making it into a source of misery.
I don't know who said it or where I'm getting the idea, but the idea of ordering our desires, ordering our loves, that ought to be what education is about, right? In other words, to train a young person to love the right things, or to like the right things, or to desire the right things.
Yeah. There's a good deal of what I teach my students. Because when you have disordered desires, even if they're not evil desires, immoral desires, satanic desires, even if they're just worldly desires, you will find perdition. And I'll give you a perfect example. This gets us back to St. Thomas. Thomas, the great behavioral scientist of 1265 in the Summa Theologiae, he said that there's four idols in life. What we really want is God. That's what we want. But God, you know, it's kind of inconvenient. There's a lot of cumbersome rules and one-sided conversations. So a lot of people want to take a little shortcut with some things that have kind of divine characteristics. And those are idols. And he said, furthermore, he asserted, and he's completely right, that there's four of them. Each one of us falls prey to one of these idols in particular. And if you know what your idol is, then, of course, you're moving the experience of the craving to your prefrontal cortex, and you're governing that idol, and you'll save yourself a whole lot of grief. He didn't talk about the prefrontal cortex, so they didn't know it existed at that point. But that's what's actually happening. The four idols are money, power, pleasure, and honor. And by honor, he didn't mean, you know, two of my kids are Marines and they serve with honor. Mm-hmm. But that's not what he meant. He meant fame or the admiration of the world, the adulation of the world. Money, power, pleasure, and honor. And he asserted, and he's right, that we like them all, but there's one in particular that beguiles each one of us. And that's the dark one works through that idol to distract us from the thing that we really want.
Mm.
And you have power. I play a game with my students called What's My Idol? So that they know. They have to read a little Aquinas. These are my students at Harvard.
Yeah.
Do you want to play?
Do I want to play the game?
Yeah.
I was hoping we might, yes.
Are you want to be a contestant on What's My Idol?
Do I have a choice? It's like I feel like I've lost control here. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go
I don't mean to lose control. It's your
no,
show.
No, go ahead.
Eric.
Go ahead.
It's your show.
Yeah.
So here's how the game works. We're going to find Eric's idol, which doesn't mean that you're subjugated to it. On the contrary.
Right.
It just means that in your weakest moments,
I may be aware of it as an idol.
Exactly right. Yeah. And everything that you regret in the past will always somehow be traced to that idol. This is the uncanny thing. When you think about a relationship that you neglected, you know, a corner that you cut that you wish you hadn't, it'll always have something to do with that idol.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So the way you play is that you don't say what your idol is. You eliminate what it's not.
Right.
In order.
Yeah.
Because one of those things you really don't care about, generally speaking, that's the
case. Right.
And when you eliminate something, it doesn't mean you don't have it at all. If you eliminate money, it doesn't mean that you're poor. It means you're the most normal person in the world. And
right.
if it's your idol, normal's bad. But if it's not
right.
your idol, normal's fine,
right.
is what it comes down to. So let's start with the one you would eliminate first. You got to kick out one. What's the one you care about the least? Or maybe even actively dislike. Money, power, which is persuasion over other people. These are not evil things. Pleasure, which might be comfort or security.
Yeah.
And the adulation of the world. Which one do you kick out first that you care about the least?
This is very hard.
Mm. This requires a spiritual retreat, actually.
I was going to say, it really is.
But this kind of is,
isn't it? Well, it's interesting because it does make you really think. What you know, what are your... Okay, so money is one.
Yep. Power, which is the...
Power.
Which is the not the control over other people, but the influence over other people. Influence.
Yeah.
They do the things that you think are right.
Right.
Pleasure is clear. We talked about that. But pleasure also encompasses comfort and security. Because, you know, it's important. A lot of people are like, yeah, I don't need to feel good all the time, but I sure as heck want to, you know, tear down my barns and build bigger barns and fill them up so I can, you know.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people like that out
there.
Yeah. Or comfort. You know, I'm like, I'm not trying to get high all the time, but I sure like sleeping in or whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then this, the adulation of the world.
Yeah.
So which one do you give away first?
I am mystified by how difficult this is for me. I think, let's say, pleasure and power, I would say...
Those are the two.
Those are pretty easy to say, like, that's not my...
Yeah.
thing.
These aren't your things, and if you had the average amount of pleasure, you'd be okay, and comfort and security, you'd be okay. And when it comes to power, now I actually believe power, and the reason is because it's not like we've been, you know, we palled around as kids, but I know about you, and you're an entrepreneur. You probably hate people having power over you, is my guess.
I never think of it that way, actually.
And dislike power and who kick away power, they don't like actually being under the thumb of anybody else. And they've lived their lives that way. So entrepreneurs are always like this. Entrepreneurs say, look, I got a lot of persuasive capacity. A lot of people do what I say, but you know, that's the one I like the least. That's the one I like the least. I'm an academic. I hate power because I'm an academic because I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. This is really what it comes down to. People who love power and that's their idol, they admire dictators. Because you admire people who have your idol.
Right, who have your
idol as well.
Right.
So I believe it. Now it's down to resources and adulation. So which you got to get rid of?
Well, the resources, like when you talk about, you say money, right? I think of money as power,
right?
Right. In other words, you can have a healthy attitude toward money. You say, well, I want that so that I mean, because I'm trying to raise money for all these projects.
Right.
It's not so I can get a boat. Or you know, it's because I think, man, these are wonderful projects.
Yeah, you just told me that money's not your idol.
Money.
You just told me money's not your
idol.
And so you kick that away next. And part of it is because you see money as a resource to do good things.
Yeah.
As opposed to that's Eric's that rich guy.
Yeah.
That's not that's like
yeah. yeah. But I mean, but then when you talk about honor or adulation or something like that, I think I also have I mean, maybe I've had to deal with that because I do know what a dark temptation that is for a lot of people.
Yeah.
They say, well, I don't want to say this because I'll lose the regard of that group. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut on this or this or this or this. But it's fascinating to me, really, that Aquinas, you know, 800 years ago just says there are four.
Therefore,
and
these four are pretty all-encompassing. People in our line of work, generally speaking, the idol is honor. Generally speaking, is. And that's, we do what we do for good reasons. Mm. I want to glorify God and edify people.
Right,
I really,
really
want to. But at the same time, I have to recognize that there's ulterior motives and there's human frailty that comes into this. You know, mine is, I'm you. I would kick out power. I would get rid of pleasure. I'm perfectly fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like money's great, but money's just money.
Yeah.
But man, this, I want people to like me.
Yeah.
And I know perfectly that when I've cut the corners, when I haven't spent the time with my children when they were little that I should have, when I haven't given my love and attention, when I've neglected my prayer life for a day or two, it's always because I'm seeking that shiny thing in the world of people liking me.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go into all the social science about how the brain is wired for people who have this particular idol. I know it. I've done the work. But the bottom line is I got to watch that. I have to watch that because I don't want to cut corners.
It's funny when you talk about honor or you phrase it that way. I'm writing a book right now about the American Revolution.
Mm.
And so
pro or contra?
I come out as pro-American.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a bold stance.
Yeah, yeah. I come out against tyranny, ultimately.
Anti-tyranny.
But yeah, yeah. So I but the reason I bring it up is because there are two figures in particular, George Washington and Benedict Arnold, both of them for whom honor was everything. And it's fascinating to watch, to look at the characters of these men and to see one of them follow it to perdition, as you put it. It's fascinating because honor really meant everything to Benedict Arnold.
Right.
And so he was very, very great. And it led him astray. Ultimately.
And he was completely principled in his pursuit of what ultimately was incorrect, what was wrong. Is that right?
He was principled. I don't know. It's a fascinating case study, actually, because it's actually heartbreaking because you see this. I mean, you know, you could say the same looking in the scriptures at Lucifer, you know, the fall of Lucifer. Well, it's because he was, you know, so great. That the temptation was there. You see this with people, right? If anybody who has a tremendous gift, it's very dangerous because that gift can, you know.
Well, because that turns to pride. And pride. Yeah. So the Luciferian case is really interesting because, you know, where, of course, he speaks Latin because, you know, the devil speaks Latin, where, you know, he says, non serviam.
Yeah.
Non serviam. I mean, this is the ultimate thing. I mean, this is the ultimate conceit of humanity.
Yeah.
Non serviam. I will not submit, which is a, you know, and it's not clear in a lot of in these cases. That's the reason I ask about Benedict Arnold. Was he saying non serviam or was he saying serviam, but to a different authority based on his moral principles?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I think. You know, anybody, if we're honest, we would say that if I feel that I haven't gotten my due, I deserve this, I deserve that. And every time I get screwed over, and it's finally I've had enough.
Right.
That's kind of his story. He was,
is that right?
Yeah, he deserved over and over. But it's fascinating. It's like there is a kind of dark thread that's always there with him. And where does that come from? But there's, it's always there that he makes enemies sort of wherever he goes.
Really, he was a problematic person.
His father was, this is now in Connecticut, right? His father was an alcoholic, and the father was publicly denied communion at church. It must have been humiliating for a young man to see your father, you know, kind of become the town drunk. And I think that he thought that with his own extraordinary gifting, he would lift the family out of shame and poverty and stuff. And so he did tremendously well as a merchant. He's in New Haven. He buys several boats, and he's sailing around the world and making tons of money. And if you're a merchant in the colonies at that time, you have to be a smuggler. In other words, you have to be eluding the British government was often, you know, asking you to pay duties and stuff, and pretty much everyone didn't.
Right.
So it was in his best interest, you know, to join the Sons of Liberty and to stand with those on the on the side of liberty. But I don't know how this happened that you're interviewing me about my future
book.
This
is super interesting. I can't wait to read the book. But, I'm getting a preview on the book.
But
you're next to be on my show about this book, but, and we'll talk about my stuff.
but he, what's so fascinating, because he was all in, and there was no one who was more heroic and successful militarily than Benedict Arnold. I mean, it's fascinating. But eventually at Saratoga, he injures himself horribly, and it leads to him getting a desk job in Philadelphia and on and on and on. But he, over and over again, he gets treated poorly, he thinks. And nobody knows at what moment he basically says, okay, I'm gonna go to the dark side. Of course, nobody thinks it's the dark side. I mean, Hitler didn't think he was doing evil. He thought he was doing good.
Well, this is the question always. You know, we attribute venal motives to our opponents so that we're sincere, and they know they're the baddies, but they're the baddies nonetheless. I mean, this is always how we look at, you know, history retrospectively, but it's also how we look at political debates today. People on the opposite side, well, they're capable of any terrible thing because they're low-integrity people, is what we say. Now, looking inward at ourselves, we're complicated. We're complicated individuals because we're fallen. We're sinners. We're men and women. And what Aquinas would say about probably Benedict Arnold, but certainly any of us, is that when we sell out our own principles, we have principles. We want God. And we will sell out our principles when we're beguiled by the idol. And what is the idol? It's the presence of the Dark One. That's the keyhole through which the Dark One comes into our lives. And when we know that, then we got power. That's power. That's godly power.
You mean when we know what our particular temptation would be, because we can guard
out.
We can guard against it.
So look out. Here's the irony. You know, we're such prideful creatures. You know, at the very bottom of Mount Purgatory, where Dante and Virgil, they find that, you know, Satan half frozen to his waist in a lake of ice.
That's,
you know,
not the bottom of Purgatory. That's at the bottom of the Inferno. But I appreciate that. Yeah, with Brutus, Judas, and
the traitors.
There are three of them.
The three
traitors.
Brutus, Judas, and...
Judas, and... Benedict Arnold, because he was after 1300 A.D. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Cassius?
And then Dante's, you know, the schoolyard bully from Dante's elementary school experience or something like that, probably.
It's like he made
his way into hell in the Inferno. But the whole point is that this pride that we have actually will even turn our idols against us, because you'll find the idol that you don't have and make that a source of pride. You see how I live with nothing?
Oh.
You see how much I don't... See how non-hierarchical I am?
Right.
You see how I lift up everybody, and everybody can call me by the first name, even though I'm the head of this hedge fund? You see? that's where the... He's so good.
Look, that's
the devil's so good at his job.
That's good. You should write a book about this.
Yeah.
You should think about it. Think about it. Just think about it. All right. Promise to think about it.
I promise to think about it. Yeah, well, I'm thinking about it right now. You're
the
making bo- me.
The book is the book that we have here is The Happiness Files, Insights on Work and Life. And there's so much in here, obviously, because it's a book of columns. But it seems to me that you're touching on the key pieces. And it has something to do with what can we call it? Mindfulness, introspection, to be willing, to dare to take stock of our lives.
This is how metacognition works, thinking about thinking, standing in awe of the great creation that is your mind and brain and self, to have gratitude for the complexity as the creature that God created. And that's one of the reasons that I love behavioral science, is because it makes me stand in awe of God's greatest creation.
That's
understand how it works.
I wish more behavioral scientists thought that way. That's extraordinary. Now, I have to ask you just biographically, how did you get started doing what you're doing, Arthur?
So I actually started off as a French horn player, which is not the typical path, I guess, to teaching at the Harvard Business School. I was a French horn player, a lot of it in the Barcelona City Orchestra all the way through my 20s. I went to college in my late 20s by correspondence. And got just interested in economics and psychology.
Is this where you met your wife?
No, I actually went there chasing her. I met her on a concert tour in France where she was studying. She lived in Barcelona. She's a Catalan girl. She's Spanish. And I moved to Barcelona in a bid to try to convince her to marry me. And we didn't speak the same language.
How'd that work out?
It took me a couple of years to get the vocabulary to figure, so she could figure out what I was saying when I was down on one knee. And it took me 2 years, but I closed the deal, and now we have kids and grandkids.
Okay, so far so good.
The French horn career didn't work out, but the more important part, the marriage did. Mm-hmm. And from there, I started studying social science because I was looking for a new path in life. I went to college, finished about a month before my 30th birthday by correspondence. I'd never set a foot on a campus. And from there, I went to graduate school because I was so interested. I was still hungry. And I went and got my PhD and became a social scientist. Then I taught for about a decade, most of it at Syracuse. And then I left and took over as president of the American Enterprise Institute, a big think tank in Washington, D.C. That's where you and I met. I did that for 11 years. And then when it was time to leave in my mid-50s, I was a little bit confused about what I was supposed to do, which people often are in their mid-50s. And so I did what Christians have done for more than 1,000 years when they have a discernment question. I walked the Camino de Santiago across northern Spain,
We've all done it.
Yeah, walking and praying every day. Lord, guide my path, I said. And entering Santiago de Compostela in northern Spain, God gave me an answer, which was to lift people up and bring them together in bonds of happiness and love using science. I went back to my roots, took a professorship, and dedicated myself to this work for the rest of my life.
How did you, if I can ask, how did you discern that? At the end of this, how long were you walking and praying?
8 days. I mean, the whole thing is 33 days, but my wife Esther said, uh-uh. You do 33 days by yourself. I'll do 8 days with you. And so, I took the eight.
Okay.
But that's okay. That's 160 kilometers, and that's not too bad.
But not bad. But did you, was there, I mean, because I'm really fascinated almost as a with a scientific curiosity about how people hear from God.
Or
some don't, but that concept of how people hear from God or discern what they think is God's will. Was there a moment for you, or was it just more general knowing?
Many religions, but particularly Christians, have a dedication to pilgrimage across many. You were raised in the Greek Orthodox tradition, and we Catholics and many evangelical people. Well, there's sort of ambulation has this admixture of spirituality and physicality, and part of the reason is because we're beings. We're not Gnostics. We believe that
Even Gnostics aren't Gnostics.
I know.
Yeah. They just think they are.
Yeah. They're just, the holy spirituality with the shell that has to fall away. But no. We believe in the resurrection of the body. We believe the body is part of us.
We are corporeal beings.
We are. And our Savior was fully God and fully man. That's a big deal for us. So we got to take it seriously. And so exercising your body, mixing your spirituality with your physicality is a really important exercise that has been so since the time of Christ. which is one of the reasons that people find when they do a pilgrimage that that the discernment comes easier. And there's a whole lot of science that goes in behind it. You're actually better able to access the dark consciousness, the right hemisphere of the brain, when you're in the process of ambulation. If you walk without devices, you're more likely to have epiphanies.
I've actually noticed that. I mean, yeah. I'm a runner, yeah. And I have noticed that.
Run without devices, yeah. You'll have your best ideas. Mm-hmm. Lift weights without devices, you'll yeah. have your best ideas. This is why you have your best ideas in the shower, because there's no devices in there unless you're some sort of weirdo.
Right.
So this is important. and so what people believe is
that's going to be a dark day when they figure out, you know, how to create earbuds that you can wear in the shower. That will be
bad. The problem is they work in the shower.
Yeah, you shouldn't have said that.
I know.
Don't say that publicly.
I know. Your whole Socrates in the yeah. city, the entire Socrates on is there, is everybody's going
to
be doing that?
People can listen to this in the shower, but don't. Well, keep going though.
So the tradition is as you walk, your discernment will be progressive. Yeah. And there was a belief, an ancient Christian belief. From the 3rd, 4th, 5th century, that upon entering Santiago de Compostela, where it's believed that the apostle St. James, the brother of St. John, sons of Zebedee, sons of thunder, that his remains are there at the cathedral of Santiago de Compostela,
really?
that God will give you discernment. But the bigger point is this. If you want to know your path, you need to pray. And that means you should do all the talking. You should pray without doing all the talking. You need to listen. There's a listening prayer. And you need to occupy yourself when you're in the process of listening. And that's a hard thing for people to do. That sounds like a one-sided conversation, but it isn't.
No, that is difficult.
It's a real hard thing to do. Catholics will do it in front of the Blessed Sacrament. You know, just like I'll recommend to a lot of fellow Catholics, if they want the knowledge that they seek, if they want God to put the knowledge on their hearts, mm-hmm. to spend time every day in front of the Blessed Sacrament. But a walking pilgrimage really does that too. And I believe that to be the case, and I strongly felt it. I strongly felt a very strong idea that my job going forward is to glorify God and edify others using science and ideas.
You're not just making this up.
Oh, I'm only making it up because it makes good copy. It makes good.
No, but how wonderful! But I mean, I kind of feel like you were already doing that.
Yeah.
Weren't you already basically doing that?
I hope so. I hope I was doing that. But there yeah. are junctures in your life. There's liminalities in your life, betwixt and between, as they say. You know, the periods, the epochs,
yeah.
and you need to find new ways to kind of spiral into a new way to express that. And I didn't know what to do. I wanted to bring to full fruition my faith and my knowledge. I mean, God gave me the ability to work in the realm of behavioral science. I'm so grateful for that. But I want to be a missionary.
Mm.
And what does it mean? You know, guide my path so I can be a missionary, so I can do it in the service of the master. You know, the master has need of it, right? I'm like that little cult. The master has need of it, right? What does that mean? What do I do? And that was the knowledge I was trying to get. I wasn't trying to figure out if I was trying to serve the master. I was how?
Right.
And that was the process of discernment that actually led me to do what I do today.
So practically speaking, what you do today is you teach.
Yeah.
You write.
Right. I speak. I'm on the road about 48 weeks a year. I'm doing between 100 and 150 talks to public audiences,
wow.
which is public education. I do a lot of media.
Wow.
Yeah, it's great.
And
beats working for a living.
You've started a new podcast?
Yeah, Office Hours with Arthur Brooks. Yeah.
It's called Office Hours
yeah.
with Arthur Brooks.
I'm just talking about behavioral science. I'm talking about the science. I'm trying to blow minds with what the data say, what the studies say, how it actually intersects with philosophy and religion. But
isn't it fascinating? I mean, I know you think it's fascinating that it does, the data does point us in directions. That, you know,
oh, yeah.
that's fascinating.
Oh,
that
yeah.
we're at a point now in the world of science
right.
where we can find this stuff, where yeah. it can help us.
It can help us. It really can. You know, it's a funny thing. If you were a scholar of, you know, Picasso, you would need to know a lot about Picasso's paintings and a lot about Picasso, the man. And you wouldn't find evidence of Picasso, the man, inside Picasso's paintings, but each would fortify the other. And in so doing, mm-hmm. and obviously it's a metaphor for faith and reason, I'm a much better Christian because of my behavioral science background, and I'm a much better behavioral scientist because I'm a Christian man.
Hmm. I think I should probably at this point ask you, how can people get this terrific product? I always want to put it as vulgarly as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
But in all seriousness, the book is available where people can get books. But how can people best be in touch with you and your work?
Yeah, everything like everybody else, it's online. ArthurBrooks.com, just like it sounds. And you know, there's all kinds of interesting tests that people can take to assess their own levels of happiness across different dimensions, all the things that I write, and the talks that I give, all the media, a lot of free resources. As a matter of fact, there's even PowerPoint presentations that people can download so they can teach my material to their family and friends and colleagues and at their school. And man, I want a movement of happiness teachers. That's what I want.
A movement of happiness teachers.
That's what I want.
Arthur, I like it. I like it. I'm sorry we're out of time, but what a joy. Thanks for being my guest today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for your work. I can't wait for your new book. When does it come out?
April 14th.
2026. Yeah. Have a good memory.
Maybe we'll push it to April 19th for, you know, Paul Revere's ride was on April 19th, 1775.
Yeah, so but it's got to come out on a Tuesday, so it'd have to be the 21st.
We'll see. Does it really?
Yeah, they all come out on Tuesday.
Okay.
I can't wait to read it. Can I have an advance copy?
Well, certainly.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
God bless you.
Thank you.